Welcome to CFRI's Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Everyone knows who you are.
Okay, I think we'll get started. Thank you so much to our panelists for being willing to share about your personal lives with everyone for the benefit of the group. So I think we have a lot of questions that we probably won't get through all of them, but I'll direct some of them to some of the panelists, and if you guys have a question that you really would like to address, just let me know. Feel free to jump in. All right, why don't we start with you, Bob? Are you in a relationship now?
Yes, I've been married since 1984 to my lovely wife, Gail, and I have a relationship with three of my kids as well.
Excellent. I'm actually going to have all of the panelists answer that question before we move on to the deeper questions. Isa?
Yes, thank you. I have been with my husband for 25 years, but married for 21. So Andrew is his name.
Colleen?
I am single.
Ooh. Emily?
I've been with my partner for 2 years. She has three boys, so I've also stepped into the role of the mean mom. And I smile, so they can't take me seriously.
Let's start at the beginning and hear what it was like for you all as adolescents in relationships and what your comfort level was with sharing about your CF. Bob, would you like to start?
Could you repeat the question? Sorry.
What was it like as an adolescent in terms of relationships, and how comfortable were you sharing about your CF?
I was pretty open with people that I trusted that knew a little bit about CF. I went to CF summer camp every year and maintained relationships and friendships via mail or phone calls or whatever. But people that didn't know I had CF, I kept it pretty quiet. I was very athletic at the time, and I was reasonably healthy. I had a dry kind of cough, but I wasn't like hospitalized a lot or anything like that. And I just felt like it wasn't that important that people knew it about it.
Thank you, Colleen.
So for me, it wasn't like a comfort thing, but. Rumor had gone around my middle school, around like 12 or 13, that I was dying. So the conversations with people at that age started happening like not on my own accord, but more as like damage control. And then it was kind of like everyone in my class knew that I had CF, but there was a little bit of like who they had heard about it from was like how serious or severe they thought it was. If they heard about it from me, they knew it just took up a significant part of my day, but that it wasn't like I had an expiration date. So there, like, the conversations were happening, but I wouldn't say that I was comfortable with them. But in that like age of my life, I had a consistent boyfriend, so it, he already knew about it when that like rumor had started. So that made that part easier, but the rest of it was not very easy.
Did any of the four of you, the other three of you have romantic relationships as teenagers and are willing to talk a little bit about what that was like?
No. My story is very complex. That'll be in my memoir.
I think I'm old, so my story of adolescence is maybe more indicative of adolescence in the 80s, where I didn't have an adolescence. I had a very, very, very delayed puberty, and probably related to poor nutritional status. So I had zero interest in any dating or romance or any boys, and the one guy that liked me was also small and scrawny, and did not have CF, but he had another issue, but I had nothing going on.
So moving into young adulthood and just regular adulthood, when you're in a romantic relationship, or if you look back when you were first with your now permanent partners, at what point did you feel comfortable sharing about your CF? Why don't we start with you, Emily?
I'll go. So Michelle is someone who I ran with for years and was also my physician when I broke my foot. You're not supposed to date your doctor. Didn't happen. It was months and months after. But yeah, we would run together, and she was also a respiratory therapist before becoming a surgeon and a doctor. So she was versed in CF, very open to listening and talking about my treatments and what CF is. But yeah, I mean, day one, she definitely knew everything, and I'm very open about it. So,
what about you, Bob?
well, my wife and I met at a CF summer camp, and she was a counselor and I was a kid. And so,
it's,
I mean,
a lot
that
of
was
scandalous
kinda,
relationship.
She needed no introduction and to the disease at all. So, 5 years doesn't make a lot of difference now, but it was significant back then.
So, have any of you, prior to these positive experiences you are currently having, have you ever had romantic interest withdraw because of or related to your CF? Colleen?
Yes, in a way. I don't think it was him withdrawing. I think it was me realizing I needed to withdraw. I had a pick line for the first time in a relationship with a guy that, like, I had been with him a few months prior to the pick line. And his, like, queasiness around the pick line was just a huge, like, all right, if this is making you queasy, like, I'm sorry, but there's a lot more coming that if you're not going to handle this, like, I'm out. and I, in talking about that with people, like, it's been years since then. I think that maybe, like, I didn't give him a chance to step up to it, but, like, I don't know, you just don't have the time to teach people how to do that. I think it's easier and less stressful to just follow your intuition about whether or not it's a red flag.
Just out of curiosity, how old were you in that relationship?
This was at 28.
Any of the three of you have had that experience?
Okay. I could answer the question you had asked earlier about telling my partner, and that was really, I think, important to me going to CF camp. It's really something I learned from other people with CF about how to communicate this, and most importantly, how to be confident that I have this disease, but it's one part of me, it's not all of me, and not feel so insecure about it. There's a lot of fish in the sea, and so if one person can't deal with the CF, I'll go on to the other. But I felt like I just want to bring that up, because I think knowing others with CF was so important to me to help me find the words, have the confidence, have the strength to be able to be so honest with it. So I told my husband about the third day of our dating, and I used it as a weeding tool. Like, this is what I have, this is what I have to do, and this is why I'm in the dorm room with my sister, and that's it. And it was sort of really, you lay it out there for me, and then I just sort of waited till he responded. And based on his response would determine whether we would have the fourth day together. And we've had 25 years.
I also kind of wanted to chime in when you said when, because I don't know if anyone read my little bio in the program, but I like thought it would be funny to share my Tinder profile. So I like, usually it's like day negative something when I'm like, they ask like, what do you mean by must be open to chronic illness? And there is like a way in which you can read how people approach that like little vague disclosure and how they're asking for more info that like really lets you know whether or not they actually are open to it or if they're just like curious. So day negative something for me.
So Issa and Colleen made me think of a question we should have added to the list. You both talked about your weeding tools. And I'm curious if Emily and Bob, before you were partnered with your current relationship, did you have any weeding tools that you used?
Just non-smoking. That's the biggest thing in the world, no smoking.
I agree with that.
Athletic and good cook.
No.
So this question is directed at our partnered panelists. So how involved with your care is your spouse or partner? Do you wish that they were more involved, less involved? Bob's laughing, so I'm going to send that to him first.
My wife and I have very different approaches to health maintenance. She does it and I don't. And it has caused conflict and stress between us at times. Just over the years as we've gotten to know each other and gotten to kind of work through some of the issues of, when is it okay for her to really just kind of push and when is it not okay? And I've gotten better over the years at being able to say, you're pushing too hard. I don't want to get to the point where I'm angry about something or whatever. Let's leave it here. She's gotten better at hearing that, which is hard for her. So I give her a lot of credit.
How about you, Emily?
Yeah, so I've been, I think medical-wise with my CF treatments, I'm very independent with that, and I always have been. And I think since Kalydeco, that's only helped. So she doesn't know me pre-Kalydeco when I was sick, Emily, which I'm kind of happy about. But because that was more intensive and I was sick more often, so she hasn't really had to see that. She pushes me with exercise and running, but then also telling me to lay on the damn couch and not do anything because I tend to go a lot until it's too much. But on the medical side, she stands back and I do that stuff at my house, aside from IV infusions if I have to. But I think it's a good balance. She does have knowledge of being a physician, and sometimes we butt heads about no, I've been living this for 37 years. I know what you think and you see in your patients is true, but that doesn't affect me. So there's little conflicts there, but we laugh about it after we fight.
Colleen, in your past relationships, how have you had your partners be involved, if at all?
I think what you said about pre-Kalydeco, Emily, there was a pre-Symdeco Colleen who needed a lot more. Judging how people act while visiting you in hospital is a huge thing for relationship, either building or breaking down sometimes. But I actually encounter more problems with people thinking that I need help with things that I just don't need help with. And then that can sometimes cause some conflict. Overall, I'm pretty independent about it now because there's a post-Symdeco Colleen that's just, it's easier.
Do you feel comfortable sharing an example of something that you were offered help with that you really didn't need help with?
Everything. I have gotten good at asking for specific things because people do want to help you when you're in hospital. So I will be very specific about, I need good food, or I need you to just come watch this TV show or football game or whatever, just this, stay here for that amount of time and then get out. I don't know. I guess it's almost a delegating role that you take on because you're I don't want your help, but you want to help. So I'm going to give you something very specific to do.
Isa, how involved is your husband?
I know a lot of people already know my story, so it's a repeat. But I think a few days after we started dating, I was hospitalized. And I didn't want my boyfriend at the time, my brand new boyfriend, to visit. And then a few months later, I had a port put in. And then at that time, I also went to Lake Tahoe with my dorm or my class senior year, and I wore oxygen. So it was an incredibly vulnerable experience. It was also our first time laying in bed together overnight. And it was embarrassing, but I just explained what I had to do. And again, it's a weeding tool. If he couldn't deal with it, then that's it. But I guess my ultimate strategy was to charm him and to make him fall madly in love with me. And that worked. And so he could, he could just overlook all of the other stuff. And as we got engaged and as we started to live together and be married, I think what was really important was that, again, CF was one part of my life. I had complete and utter independence in my self-care, except for I'm old school, so I did chest PT. So my sister and I did chest PT for each other. And then when my sister was transplanted, Andrew really did take over and started to do chest PT for me, even before my sister was transplanted, when she found a partner and so on. So this disease impacted him every morning and every night for 30 to 45 minutes a time. And often it came down to him not being able to be out for meetings or work events late at night. He did travel, but we had to coordinate it with my sister and my mom and everybody sort of figuring it out. So he dove deep into the CF world, including my end-stage disease. And so CF has played a major role in his life. And I think the blessing of being 47 now is that over the years of feeling guilty that I was imposing on him a burden and work and, you know, pain in the ass that CF is, like now I can look back and say that this illness and the experiences connected to it has actually profoundly shaped him as a person and made him more appreciative of life in general and have an outlook on life that he would have really never gotten if he sort of was in a different world. So that's a big issue that I want to share. And I say that CF was one part of me, but of course, as my illness progressed, it became a dominant part of me. And but at the same time, I think my emotional support was not just relying on him alone. I had my family, I had this CFRI, I had retreat and camp in the old days. And today, I'm 15 years post-transplant, so I don't actually need him to take care of me. And it's been a great liberation for both of us. He's actually in Egypt today. So he can do whatever he wants now. And that's kind of the reward for his caregiving, is the freedom that he has now. But I think his primary role in my life right now, of course, is health insurance and also emotional support. Just listening to my complaints and my worries and my bodily issues here and there, and just being a sounding board and a witness to what it's like to grow older with CF.
So this next question was actually inspired by the CFRI Caregivers Support Group. This came up in a previous group, and I wanted to pose a similar question to the panel. So I just want to ask you to think about when you started incorporating your significant other or a past significant other into your life, you know, when it was clear that they were going to be a really important person. And for anyone, not just people with CF, anyone, that can be a challenge in terms of your family, you know, and then adding the CF adds another layer. So I would appreciate if you guys could share a little bit about what that was like, the family dynamics. Like, for example, as a young adult, if your parents were the primary people that sort of helped you manage your CF, and then they sort of get not replaced, you know, it's a complicated thing, right? And I'm curious to hear what your varieties of experiences have been with that. And Emily, I saw you reacting with your face, so I'm going to go to you first.
Yeah, okay, my face is very responsive. So growing up, I grew up in the 80s, so we had chest percussion, like Issa was saying, so very dependent on them for that part of it. They did start me at an early age doing my own treatments, which we talked about last night, me and a set of parents, about how my parents gave me Pulmozyme and gave me the things to administer myself and teach me about it, so I understood. And then with that, I understood the importance of compliance, right? So throughout childhood and teen, my parents were kind of my direct caregivers and support. My two older brothers helped. They liked chest therapy, doing that on me. They could beat me up a little bit. And then I moved out on my own with my oldest brother when I was about 18 or 19. We moved downtown in Detroit. And that's also when I slipped on my meds, so I stopped doing my meds like I should have. And my vest was collecting dust, and my health was declining, right? So that's a pattern there. So clearly I knew what my treatments are for and what I should do with them, but I was living in the world of, am I even going to be alive? So why do this? Playing the drums in a rock band and being foolish. So, and my brother, being a great older brother, he taught me how to party and drink, but didn't really help take care of me, right? So it was a learning experience, and as I moved older and took control of my life, which is something we all have to do at a certain point, is really gain control of our life, and I started exercising and then doing my treatments super on the reg, that became my thing. And today I still have my parents who will drive down in a heartbeat. They were at my house last week painting my house, and I went into the hospital and they were there for me, and then Michelle was there for me, and everyone else checks in, but it's still like me providing my care, but when I do need help, I'll seek it.
Thank you. Colleen, any experiences you want to share? Family dynamics?
I think that like what Asa said about the primary caregiving role being like providing insurance was hilarious, but so true. Like I was in a relationship, a pretty long, serious one, and like the prospect of marriage came up so much sooner than it should have, because if we got married, he could then provide the insurance. And that whole way of that conversation coming about was just icky, but like that's the reality of like our situation in America right now. So yeah, at some point I am going to have to shift from, I'm very lucky, I'm a disabled dependent on my mother's insurance still at 33. At some point that is going to have to shift, and I think that's going to be the biggest shift for me, because I didn't grow like, you know, my parents are providing the medications and the space to do them like financially and everything, but it's always sort of been me. Of course there's nagging when I was younger about not sleeping in too late so that I could do them before school and whatnot. And I think just like Emily said, like when I went to college, there was a drop in compliance because I was like, no one's nagging me. I'm gonna sleep, but also I'm not gonna miss class. And yeah, so my parents helped me navigate that like balance and time management. And then, you know, I had to figure that out on my own, but I don't foresee that shifting to anyone else's responsibility at this point, but maybe in the future, I don't know. It'll be a new balance game to figure out.
Thank you. Isa?
I sort of cheated. I had my parents, and then I had my complete and utter dependence on my sister, Anna, and we took care of each other for probably 10 years, eight to 10 years before my marriage. So it was I was very fortunate to live away from home and to be very independent. Of course, relying on my parents for medical disability until my wedding day, and then also relying on them for financial support as well. So it was kind of that good old fashioned transfer from parental dependence to then sibling dependence to dependence on my husband. Yeah.
You're up, Bob.
Well, when I left home, I was pretty young when I left home, and at the time I really didn't need much. And you know, my parents are not very good at, you know, taking good care of me like that, and my health over the years has kind of declined, but I was already married, you know, when I started really needing a little more attention. So it kind of developed naturally.
Thank you. So I want to put this question to all of you. Thinking back either on your current relationship or on past relationships,
Are there things that you would do differently now if you could do them over again? Colleen?
I think I'm the safest person to answer this because I'm not going to offend any significant other that doesn't exist. That's why I laughed. But I didn't really have an answer while I was laughing. Yeah, I think you live and you learn through everything that may have gone wrong, and I'm not thinking of any specific, but like I said about learning how to delegate things where people feel like they're helping even though you don't necessarily need it, like there is, like, I've learned to allow people to have that feeling of being helpful. That sounds so weird. Yeah, like not pushing it away, like allowing them to also go through the experience of whatever they're going through without making it like all about me. Definitely not dating smokers ever again. Like what was I thinking? Yeah, also no cats, but that's not like a CF specific, that's just allergy specific. I'm gonna respect that part of my health as well. Yeah, I guess certain environments, and I think I've also learned that maybe certain like job lifestyles don't necessarily fit my life, like what they do for a living, impacting their hours, impacting my hours. So just like the respect for like my need for like rest and a consistent schedule where I am able to do my medications in a timely and not skipping fashion. Just little things, but like those things can be worked out, but because I like my schedule right now. Yeah, I don't know if that's a live and learn. I don't know. That was a ramble. Thanks for listening.
What about you, Issa? What would you do differently? Or a rephrase of the question is, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Nice. I think along the same lines of what Colleen said, I think CF can be incredibly self-absorbing and selfish. And it's all we're really doing is trying to survive and protect ourselves. But I think, you know, and I don't think I did this intentionally, but just being able to balance our lives a little bit more. Of course, when somebody has a life-threatening illness and is end stage, there's no help. We can't help it. We have to focus on what's most urgent. But and I've tried to do this. I have tried to do this, to get out of myself and to ask him, what's important to you? What do you need? What support can I give you? And I mean, I've always had this philosophy, maybe because of my parents, like they're very, very independent people. And so Andrew and I are two very independent people who happen to share a bed at night and sleep, you know, live in the same place, but and then care and are committed to each other. But he can live his life, he can pursue his passions and interests, and I can pursue mine. And yet we have to come together at least sometimes to just maintain the relationship. That was much harder when he was my caregiver, but there was still times when he was able to pursue his relation, his interests and passions. But there were a lot of times where I couldn't go with him to his outings or his, you know, club events and so on, because I was sick, and that was a disappointment. So I guess I'm just saying it's all a balancing act of doing the best we can on both sides and really making the time and finding the time to find what our common ground is in our lives. I don't think I answered your question, but...
Yes, you did.
Okay, yeah. All right.
What about you, Bob?
I was thinking about this, and the first thought I came up with is that I think I would pursue communicating my wants and needs about my health better with my partner. But as I thought about it, I realized I didn't really have my own thoughts fully organized about what I wanted to do with my life and how I wanted to take care of myself. And I was kind of ambivalent about it a lot. And so, you know, I don't know that there was much for me to communicate either, you know, but I think in general, just being more communicative would have about health issues and all that. I wish I had been capable of that more.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Emily?
All right, I got two for this one. The first one is I'm a people pleaser, and I need to make sure everyone else is taken care of before myself. So it's something I'm still working on today. Every day it's like, it's okay if the dishes don't get done or the boys' lunches don't get done. I have to go home and do my treatments. So it's stuff I struggle with every day, and I have my whole life. When I was playing in the band, I'd be like making sure everyone in the band is taken care of and their equipment is put away, and we load out of the smoky bar, and then I go home, and instead of doing my treatments, I go to sleep, right? So making sure I'm taking care of myself and putting my needs first, at least health-wise, are something I struggle with and need to improve on. And then the other thing is, if I could talk to my younger self, like, just don't be afraid of who I am. And that was something, I'm a minority in the minority, is what we're calling it. So a member of the LGBTQA plus I group. Did I get all of them? So I think I look back, and I'm in therapy, obviously, because we deal with a lot of things with CF, anxiety and depression. And looking back and realizing the thought I had was, why even express who I really am if I'm not going to live? Because I thought I was going to die from CF early, so I didn't even bother searching or living that part of my life, because why, right? When people are always like, yay, CF, and then the other side is, boo, this is bad, you shouldn't be that. So, like, there's an inner struggle that I have had and still have to this day, because I think our society's ready, and then I turn on the news, and they're not ready. So it's a really hard thing inside, right? Yeah, it makes you not sleep at night. But yeah, I think it would just be like, pursue who you are, be happy, and start earlier so you're not playing catch up.
Thank you. So this is a related question. The last one that I'll put to you guys, and then I'll open it up in case the audience has questions that they want to put to the panel. So what advice would you give other people with CF looking for love?
Do we sing that song, Looking for Love, in all the right...
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I don't know the words, so you're next, Colleen.
Go ahead, Colleen.
I want to hear your song.
Oh, wait, what are we doing? Tell. Oh, looking what for song? Love in all the right places. Wrong song? Places?
I don't know the song.
I'll play it at the dance tonight.
I would say, like, just, you know, I was not really a part of the CF community until I really, really needed you guys when I became sick, and this was pre-Symdeco, Colleen. And like meeting people who had long-lasting relationships was like so new to me, and I think that I would tell my younger self, like, you don't have to go about relationships like they're not gonna last or that you're dying, which is maybe really powerful for adolescents now because their trajectory has changed so much. Mm-hmm. But also, if you don't want a long-lasting relationship and you just want what you want right then, that's fine too. So that would be my advice. Like, don't rule it out, but if it's not what you want, don't beat yourself up about that either.
Thank you. Bob, words of wisdom?
I think I would recommend what I would recommend regardless of whether people had CF or not, mm-hmm. that, you know, you pursue things to round out your personality and to be happy with who you are, and not kind of wait for that other person to fill this gaping hole in your life. And I think that's really important in general, just for everybody.
Thank you.
I would definitely add to that. I think it took me a long time to love myself and to love the CF and accept the CF and own it as something that I have, and it's not a defect, and it's not, it's a pain in the butt, but it's something I can say I have openly, just like I have brown hair and I'm German and Japanese, I have CF, so it's part of my identity. And once I was truly confident with that and completely at peace with it, then I actually had a lot of people pursuing me. I don't want to sound like that. I had three people. I had three people at the same time, and I was like, whoa, what's going on here? But it was because I kind of shifted to a place of confidence. And confidence, apparently, at least in my experience, was attractive. And it was kind of a groundbreaking thing for me that I had this experience of confidence with who I was. And I was going to say something else, and I just blanked out. I think my other advice is to, and this is so hard because sometimes it's just not easy to do, but to separate from your parents, to grow up if possible, not necessarily financially, but to live, you know, if possible. I know some people can't do this, and I acknowledge that because survival is more important than anything. But that healthy separation from parents so that you can find your own self and then you can find a partner. I think you guys said it, like letting go of fear, letting go of those terrifying thoughts of nobody's gonna love you because of your CF, or you're not worthy of love because of your CF, or some other issue that you have in your life. Those are just thoughts. And we need, you know, we need to come to you to talk about them, to let those things go. So.
Thank you.
I second that. I think the biggest thing is you have to love yourself before you can let anyone else love you or you love them, right? And that's something that I know probably a lot of people struggle with, right? Is that self-love head to toe and accepting who you are, all the craziness involved, right? So I think...
All the mucus and everything.
All the mucus and gas. Where's... Devin. So yeah, I think definitely that, and then knowing that you deserve love and to be uplifted, but you can also give that back just as strong and find somebody who treats you with respect and supports you and makes your life amazing, because you deserve that. Everyone deserves that, but sometimes it's hard to think that when you're going through stuff like that we go through every day.
I do want to chime in and say that, like, you don't have to prevent relationships from happening just because you're hating yourself a bit, because I spent a long time hating myself a bit, and I found that relationships actually helped me hate myself less. Like, if other people are viewing you as lovable, sometimes that can help you then also view yourself as lovable. And yeah, so the whole, like, gotta love yourself first, like, maybe. You'll get there.
I like that, because as someone married for 21 years, I think you don't have to be complete when you meet someone. You grow together with them over time. I think this is the case for people without CF too. You grow together. You're not sure what you're going to turn out to be like in 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, but you walk together along that path to find out. Yeah.
Thank you, guys. So I want to give the audience an opportunity either to pose questions to the panel, or because I know we have CF patients and their family members in the audience, if you have your own insights from listening to this conversation that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear them.
This has been a wonderful opportunity. All of you, thank you for being so open and kind of almost being a book that, you know, is said to all parents that you never get. So my question is, you know, our daughter is 12. She's newly diagnosed, so she remembers being not sick, even though she was much sicker then. She's been warning us, as has our care teams, that the teenage years can be rather bumpy. And what advice would you maybe offer as far as how parents can help facilitate that? How much, you know, how much should we let go and just, or, you know, how much do we need to stick? You know, I know everything's a little different, but do you have instances where, you know, this worked, or you wish that your parents would have, you know, dot, dot, dot?
You want to go first?
That's heavy.
Yeah, come on.
So obviously I don't have the late diagnosis experience, and that lining up with like puberty is going to be hard. Providing her with the opportunities to see a counselor is going to be real important, I think, or could be real important. I know as a teen, I didn't want to talk to a counselor, or I would like lie. Yeah, so maybe also providing opportunities for her to connect with other teenage girls who have CF. I don't know how, maybe through Instagram or, like, I don't ever tell people Facebook because there's a lot of real strong personalities on there. But having some kind of emotional support through that that maybe isn't like an authority or is just kind of a peer could be very valuable. I do know a woman who had a late diagnosis who, like, had a lot of self-esteem issues following it. Like, who's going to find me sexy now? And I think it's important to highlight, like, you've always had CF. We just didn't know about it. And so who you are doesn't suddenly change because of this late diagnosis. Like, you can still be sexy AF and have CF. So,
that's in her profile. I'll add to that. I know we've kind of talked about in the past, we've had discussions about your daughter and the situation. I think one thing my parents never did is, I mean, they were great at the way we treated CF, and we didn't make it a focus, and it wasn't, you have CF, you can't do this, you have CF, you should do this, you're awesome, you have CF. CF was never really part of the conversation except for when it was treatment time or whatever, I got sick, but we never let it navigate any part of our life ever. The flip side is we never really discussed our feelings in real life, so it was always like, how are you doing? Great. I think I said that last night, everything's fine. And we never really, my parents never asked me about potential relationships for me or if I was crushing on anybody, which is what I ask Michelle's boys all the time to see what they're up to. But we never had those open dialogues, right? But my parents never did treat me different, which I appreciate. And I think that would be an approach for all parents is sure your kid has CF, but treat them and navigate them as if they don't. Because it, even though she might focus that I have CF and she has these inner thoughts like it makes me different, I'm not lovable, that's fine, address those, but then don't even just let her do everything else and navigate with her the journey of a teenager without CF, and CF's just along for the ride.
Any other responses from the panel on that question?
If you don't mind, I would add that I think it's so important, for at least for me, to have something in the normal world that I was really good at. Something like, for me, it was art and painting t-shirts and having a business, or it was schoolwork. Something I was strong, you know, had a talent in or a skill or something that fed my self-esteem. And if I had self-esteem, I guess now with my social work head, I can say it gave me a sense of worth. And if I'm worth something, because I'm good at something, or I could give something back to the world, then I'm worth taking care of, because I have things to look forward to in the future. I'm worth myself. I want my life. I own my life. And that, I think that's hard to teach kids. I mean, you can show it by example. I think all of us have a very strong sense of worth. Pursuing, you know, the running and the rock CF. It doesn't have to be CF related. It could be something else of her choosing. But I think, are you worth enough? Are you worth it to work so hard to stay alive? That's the big question we're all asking ourselves. And I think most people in this room would say yes. But it's a hard path to get there.
Thanks for your bravery. Oh boy. But anyway, this is not just for CF. The legalization of common law is no longer. Did you find the getting of the insurance or any other legal factors an encouragement to tie the knot?
An encouragement to what?
Tie the knot.
I think now that I'm not no longer on disability because Kalydeco, they said I'm too healthy for that, which motivated me to try to figure out how to live my life. So that led me to the Affordable Care Act and Marketplace. So I buy my health insurance through that, which is great. So I don't need to marry somebody to get coverage, right? I pay a premium. I meet my deductible the first day of the year, and everything's great. So, I mean, in the past, there were those issues, and there still are people who aren't in my situation that do have to either divorce somebody so they can get Medicaid or Medicare, or the opposite, get married so they can get healthcare. So healthcare is a ever-debatable topic, but for me, it's great, and the Affordable Care Act is why I'm alive and able to do these things and have zero copays all year.
Did you want to add something, Colleen? Or? You spoke to this a little bit earlier in that the relationship.
Yeah,
thing.
No, I don't feel. I was thinking just now about like. So I was on a trajectory of qualifying for disability at one point in my life, and it was kind of rough to go through that whole. Oh my God, I'm not sick anymore. Great, but. Shit, how do I pay for things? and so luckily I never went off my mom's insurance, because my impression is kind of that once you do change to being independent, which for me would have been the disability route, that it's very hard to get back. So I guess fortunately I didn't qualify, but also kind of like, now I still do feel a little laden to my parents, and like I would like her to retire at a decent age. And so like I will have to figure that out soon, and I'll probably go the Affordable Care Act route. But no, I don't feel that it the prospect of being someone's dependent encourages me to want to tie the knot at all. It's almost the opposite.
Anything else to add from Issa or Bob? Anything to add?
No.
Okay. I was just very fortunate. I met a man who had pursued higher education and was able to get a good job with excellent health insurance. And it was a safe way to go from mom and dad to that. And I know not everyone is so fortunate, but it certainly helps to find someone who is employed in a very good organization that has a lot of options for healthcare. Yeah, so I know people who can't get married for healthcare reasons, and it's a sad commentary. So.
What other questions from the audience?
Hi, so I have this question from Madeline, who's joining this conference remotely. I wonder how your parents managed to keep you on their health insurance as disabled adults. I tried to do this for 8 months with my daughter and failed. Kudos to your parents.
My mom, I'm very fortunate that my mom has a very good job with a international company with like large amounts of resources. It was a process through her, like I think it was HR. It was some department in her big, huge corporation that she had to go to and talk to you about this, because it's sort of at this point, because I'm not on disability, it's like a tax dependency, like because I'm living in her home, because I'm still a child dependent, there's a bunch of things they went through to work out that it was legal. And I guess it's almost a gray area where if someone did want to come audit me, please don't. Mm-hmm. I'm just very fortunate that that happened, and I don't think that that option is available through all plans. Like, I'm Blue mm-hmm. Cross Blue Shield through a huge corporation. If your parents' provider is not that large scale, I just don't know if that's even an option.
Yes, so when I was on disability and Medicare and Michigan Special Health Care, my primary was still my dad's up until I was, I just bought into the exchange like 4 years ago. So until I was about 34, I'm not good at math, 33, all we needed for me to qualify, and my dad's retired from teaching, so I was on his retired Blue Cross plan, was a note from my CF physician stating I was disabled because it matched up to my disability, and that would keep me on their insurance. But obviously, that's no longer. But yeah, there's definitely hoops to jump through.
My understanding, again, this is a long time ago, but that I was able to work part-time and be on medical disability insurance. And this was with Kaiser, and the reasoning was that without health insurance, I would become disabled almost immediately. And so, and then the cost of the medications would be prohibitive. And the inability to get insurance because of pre-existing condition, which is less of an issue now. So, of course, things change, but I think it's true with CF that without health insurance, we will become disabled pretty quickly. I will become disabled without really quickly, and the cost of the medicines continues to be, really prohibitive for us to, you know, get health insurance and survive without health insurance.
So just in terms of the designation as a dependent adult, I just want to acknowledge every situation is different and just remind everyone about the resource of CF Legal. They have a lot of knowledge about that topic if you have personal questions about your individual situation. We have a few more minutes, Siri? 10 more minutes. Okay, any other questions from the audience?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming up and speaking today. I am so thrilled, and it's so vindicating, the development of psychosocial support through CF clinics now. I wish that those sort of things existed when I was a puberty, teenager, sexuality, all these questions coming into play. So I guess the question is, sort of like, you know, speaking to your younger self, but also like speaking to your parents who are ultimately the ones who are guiding you, you know, hypothetically, during that age period. But, you know, how should, would, could adolescents utilize psychosocial supports through the CF clinics to, I don't know, just promote like, just more holistic wellness in terms of, you know, their identity as a person with CF, as, you know, as they're growing into their sexuality, et cetera. So is that question pretty clear or no?
Yes.
Okay.
But maybe because I know you.
Okay.
Thank you. For me, I would say to my younger self, like, one, talk to your clinic about your birth control because it can affect some of the drugs you may be taking, or vice versa. Which I think Tracy talked about a lot of the things that I would tell my younger self to bring up in clinic. But maybe, like, you know, that could be the first conversation with your team that makes them view you as a sexual being, and I think that just subtle shift in the way that you go from being a child to a teenager, it's, you know, it's the puberty thing, gives you more of the support you need. And that, like, even if you're not gonna go on a pill, even if you're not gonna like ask about how to use a condom or whatever, bringing it up, I think, can be a really valuable, like, growing up catalyst for the team's view of you, so to speak. So, like, if there's something happening in your life that is shifting you to being, like, more of, yeah, I'm going to ramble here because I'm not real clear on, like, even what I'm... Yeah, but also I recognize that parents still come into the room when you are that age. And I, I am in contact with a lot of young adults who have CF through my Instagram account, and I get questions like this. I want young people to know that clinic is available by telephone and by email without your parent present. And if you want to contact your doctor about a question that you don't want your parents to hear, go be independent and do that. Even just saying something like, hey, at my next appointment, can you ask for some one-on-one time with me because I want to talk about some things? It's scary and it's weird, but like, I think we all know that like judgment threat-free zone to talk to your team one-on-one can be really important at that age. And I don't want to make any of the parents in the room feel bad about that either, because I think that when you went through that period of your life, you also didn't maybe want to involve your own parents, and the information is important for you to have. But I guess on the psychosocial front, that's more of like becoming empowered and independent, and like that shift that you're experiencing through young adulthood, like just kind of starting it there and seeing how the rest follows. I think I rambled far off that question. I'm sorry, thank you.
I also want to, when you were talking about asking, like a teenager asking for one-on-one time, if you're a parent of a teenager, I think you can also proactively offer the, if you want your child to have some of that time and they might not ask for it, you can volunteer to leave the room and let them have some one-on-one time with their providers. Anything?
Yeah, I think in clinic, and I mean, it's a great point that you bring up, future president. But right there.
Sonia 2020.
Yeah, she's 2020. Write her in. Up until recently, my CF visits from childhood till a few years ago were just strictly lungs, weight, enzymes. Like, that's it. Like, nothing else. Like, the social worker would come in awkwardly and be like, so, how's it going? And I'm like, I'm good. I'm safe at home. You know, like, CPS, don't you need to call them? So that's like, in my mind, that's what social workers do. They make sure you're okay. So, I'm cool. So I'm like, get out of here. You hold me up. But I think now that I've recognized the mental health issues or things that we deal with, and actually recognize myself, and then hearing others, adults, and even teens talking about their own, and now with Alexander Quintner's work with the surveys that we take beforehand at clinic, I mean, that's opening that door for discussions about mental health, which is related to sexual health, and the awesome reproductive presentation that was just before this was amazing, and we're getting there. I don't think we're there yet, but some patients and doctors or their team have that different relationship where they can talk about it, but it's still awkward, and it shouldn't be. And I think, like we said, the earlier you start, the better. And I like the discussion about, at 10 years old, talking to your kid about the issues they have with reproductive health, like starting them at that age and making it comfortable, then you can address it in clinics.
Last question.
Can I just add one more thing? Sorry to ramble here, but disclaimer, I haven't been to CF clinic in 15 years, but looking back at my youth, I think the CF team has a profound influence on who I am today. I'm not the CF team. I didn't go to CF Center, but the medical world. There's a reason I work in healthcare, because I develop a comfort level within the teams. But I think one of the most important parts of surviving CF is some sort of emotional intelligence, and to know thyself, you know, to really say to really be able to look inside and think about what we want, what we need, what we can say out loud that we need, and so on. And so I think having people ask us that and then wait and listen for our answer, I think it can shape our own development. So I just wanted to share that even if somebody says, I don't know, which usually is the case, right, with a teenager, but they're still thinking about it, to allow that and be with that, and eventually the I don't know will become, well, I, and then they will have something to say, so, yeah.
We have time for one more.
So I wanted to ask about how the conversation around reproductive goals and becoming or not becoming a parent someday had affected your relationships and what advice you may give to people who are navigating those decisions.
I'll answer that. We wanted to have kids eventually. We were married 10 plus years before we did. And we adopted all three of our kids, and it was just such a natural thing that, you know, my wife was like, I'm not missing anything being pregnant, you know, or not being pregnant. And so it was a, I've kind of lost track of what I was saying, but anyway.
I actually wanted to say, excuse me, I'm just hoarse. I actually wanted to say on the adoption front that, because, you know, when you can't have children, then you meet everybody else who can't have children. Yeah, just the way it goes. And then our kids are interracial adoption, so everybody knows we adopted, so then they all come out of the woodwork to talk to us. But, which is fine, thanks. But I actually, there was a really subtle difference in what we had to say about adopting. And a lot, I heard a lot of people saying, we have to adopt. And for us, we got to, because he was living a long time. You know, it's like, hey, we get to go and do this. And so I think it just, if I wasn't here for the other discussion, I was listening to the research, I would just throw that one out there. That's like my little freebie today for all of you. If you're thinking about what you want to do as a family, do you want to be that family of more than two adults? Do you have to, or do you get to? So, very good.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful note to end on. I want to thank our panelists for their openness, willingness to share their stories. Thank you.
Thank you.